Colin Cullis, good evening. Great to have you back on Business Unusual.
How's it, Ray? And a happy 2019 to you.
And to you too. Okay, now listen, talking 2019, you've made predictions in the past on the Business Unusual. What do we need to know about the past so we can sort of have a great future?
So the first thing I'd say is next year will be the best year for making predictions because, of course, it's 2020. You can't get it wrong. But 2019 is still going to be a little tricky, which is why I opted to rather go and have a look at the predictions that we've already made to see how many of them have come true, as it were, or gone horribly wrong, before sort of weighing in for how likely it's or where it's likely to go. And generally, we tend to sometimes find products that sort of make a bit of a splash and then they're all big thing and then they disappear, while the underlying technologies, they often take much longer to develop. And so sometimes you write off the product, even though the technology it introduced actually over time does turn out to be kind of impressive. So this evening, I'm going to take a look back at some of the things we've done. So Uber, autonomous vehicles, 5G communications, bitcoins, that's in there, clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats, which most people just refer to as CRISPR, or if that even doesn't make sense, gene editing we'll look at, machine learning, and a little mention of Facebook and Netflix along the way. So we kick off, though, with Uber. That happened to be the subject for the first episode of The Slot in 2015. And in the 9 years it's kind of been around, it's had its fair share of controversy despite having become a really massive company. It's likely to list this year some market cap or IPO sort of listing figures in the excess of $100 billion for what it will be worth. And if you had to calculate how many trips it's given, well, they've managed to effectively take every person alive on Earth for a trip at some point. That's over 7 billion trips in the 9 years it's been around. And as a comparison, Walmart's the kind of largest employer, 2.3 million employees. Had Uber said, sure, all the drivers are employees, well, it'll have over 3 million of them. So very impressive. And on that basis, you'd say that prediction was a sure bet. It's an absolute winner. But there is a catch.
Yeah.
Uber doesn't make money yet. It's not profitable. So when you list as a company, of course, nobody's looking to buy a share and not see it turn a profit. So there is going to be pressure along with many, many other competitors that it has, more and more regulations, and invariably still a decision, a way of managing what the drivers are in relation to Uber that will need to be resolved. And while they're reducing their losses, the point at which they can reduce the losses to become profitable, i.e. get back into the black, might just be the point that on the roads, they're back in the red. So it's still one that is a wait and see, even though what Uber has given us is the notion of how disruption works, the focus switch from the sort of product. The state taxi industry said, well, we look after the taxis. And Uber said, we look after the customers. They use technology to enable something that wasn't available in the past. And they really got the benefit of investors with very deep pockets who were willing to take a risk on a new platform, which is kind of the hallmark for most of these sort of things. One of the solutions potentially Uber will enjoy seeing happen is autonomous vehicles. And we first picked up on it in 2017 when the undertaking was that 5-year-olds in 2017 would never need a driver's license. Effectively, by then, when they had turned 18, 2030, somewhere in there, cars would be capable of driving themselves and there's no need for us to drive. In fact, some people argue that legislation might need to be enacted to stop us driving as we are principally the biggest threat on the road.
We absolutely are. Would you trust a driverless car? We had that guy in that advert on Chapman's Peak, and he was the same guy that went down in the bends down Chapman's Peak, and they said to him, listen, tell you what, we're going to put you back in a more advanced Mercedes Benz, and we're going to take you around Chapman's Peak. And he did it. He trusted it. Would you?
Now, that's a great point, actually, because besides that ad, which demonstrates how far we've come already, Elon Musk, because he often gets asked not just about the electric vehicles, but making them completely autonomous. And his point is that getting a car 95% autonomous is kind of easy. It's that last 5% that is very hard. And it's in that last 5% that we begin to trust the car. But it's not just the technological thing I think they're going to need to sort out. I think they're pretty much going to manage to do that. The questions relate for me to the ethics. How will we program a driverless car? Should it protect you, the driver, at all costs, so to the detriment of everybody else? Or would you buy a car, not only that you trusted to get you around, but perhaps that was told if you're going to plow into a crowd of people, rather take a sharp left and stick you in a wall because that's going to be the safer thing to do.
Charming.
And then there are legal considerations. Imagine when you've got the time when you've got driverless cars and regular driven cars and there is an accident. Would the owner of a self-driving car have to convince an insurance company that it was the other driver's fault, his fault, or the car manufacturer's fault? Because, of course, when you're not driving the car, how do you get held liable for what it did?
Exactly.
And similarly, the reason the car might have an accident is that it lost its communications. It couldn't navigate anymore. In which case, is that your fault? Is that the manufacturer's fault? Or is it your mobile company data supplier's fault?
Wow.
Those things, I think, are going to... Yeah, they're going to be a little tricky still to sort that all out. Although, in terms of communications, that is a big leap forward. 4G communications now, I don't know if you've ever done those little apps where you can check the speed on your phone and you might see 50 megabits per second download speed. It's like, woohoo, I'm winning. Well, yeah. 4G can get you up to and around 1 gigabit of speed. So here in South Africa, we still got plenty of opportunities to see a lot of improvements on that. But remember, 5G is promising to sort of kick around the 5 gigabits per second and theoretically can get up to 20 gigabits per second. Those are just arbitrary random numbers that make no sense to anybody. So if I had to turn that into something at that theoretical maximum or the theoretical possible 20 gigabits per second, that would be like you watching an hour's worth of high definition HD Netflix, an hour's worth, and getting it downloaded onto your phone in just over a second.
Wow, amazing. Absolutely amazing.
It's blindingly fast. And the other thing that we tend to still notice with our mobile communications that you click a link and you wait a couple of seconds for it to respond and then open and then download. 5G, basically for our purposes, human purposes, the latency will be so low, you click a link and it appears. You'd think you're actually just navigating right there. The catch, though, we need a lot more of these little towers and transmitters. They're not these big things that can cover kilometers worth. They need to be much more closely clustered. And you know how hard it is to get permissions to put these things up and how are we going to respond if there's so many more of them.
Palm trees. Yeah.
Yes. And they all need to be powered. And so when power interruptions are potential, then you've got to put batteries in them or you've got to put generators near them to power them. It becomes a logistical nightmare for where they're going to go. And some are even a little worried that it could create a bit of a digital divide because the larger, richer sections of cities will probably get this rolled out first, possibly leaving everybody else without the ability to access the really high-speed, awesome stuff. The final consideration, and it's not really a South African one, but countries like the US are a little worried that most of the infrastructure that currently is being built for 5G technology is done by companies like Huawei. And they're a little concerned that Huawei and the relationship with the Chinese government might not be in the interest of the US government and how it might relate to what would happen in the US. So it's very, very likely to be implemented. I suspect that the first sort of major tests and possibly full versions are already enrolled out by the end of 2020 to some cities in smaller pockets, but certainly going to be there. There's no question that we're not going to say, oh, actually, it was a bad idea. Let's roll it back. But there are still quite a few things that we're going to have to solve before we get that right. And then we'll look at something.
Sure.
Then we'll look at something that it could have gone better than it did. Some people thought it was amazing, and it kind of failed. And this is the classic: the product failed, the technology could live on, and that was Bitcoin. So when we first touched on that in May 2017, it had just passed the $1,400 for a Bitcoin mark. The thing that was interesting about that is that it was now worth more than an ounce of gold. And it seems maybe that psychological thought in people's head, and the fact that it was launched in 2009, so it's taken almost 10 years to get to the point where people said, wow, this is the great new thing. And the hype cycle kicked in. This is a Gartner sort of idea that sometimes when a new technology comes along that we really don't actually understand, most new technologies, I suppose, fall into that category, we tend to treat it a bit like magic. We tend to have an overinflated expectation for what this thing can do. And Bitcoin certainly seems to have fallen very, very foul.
Well, it's gone now. Absolutely. Did you ever consider buying Bitcoin, joining the big hype?
I did. I for the purposes of being able to cover it, I went and found out how hard it is to buy Bitcoin, even consider maybe mining Bitcoin. And I got to say, for my part, for the time when I entered and the time when I got out, it was a very good little exercise for me. Yeah. I did leave before it started getting completely crazy in December. And for some of it, if it goes down, unless you sell it, you haven't lost money. So there is still a very strong belief by many people who are into cryptos that says, as long as you don't sell it, you have haven't lost your money. So if you've left your money and then you're fine. As soon as you, you know, if you bought high and you're selling low, well, that's the point where you lose it. I can't see it getting back to the $20,000 mark, which it actually hit at the tail end of 2017. Right now, it's sitting at about $4,000, which is still significantly up from when we first covered it. But I think it's not so much the Bitcoin and possibly not even the blockchain that's going to do so much for us in the future. But the idea of this improved public ledger has given financial institutions an opportunity to relook at the effectiveness of their own systems. And and there's one in particular that I think could be a very good contender for challenging currency. And it's something that here in Africa we've been quite happy to do. And it's the ability to use airtime as a currency. M-Pesa and things like that have allowed people to say, well, here's a digitally tradable currency that is a service, that is a product. And in the future, us, our reticence has usually been saying, we don't believe that a purely digital thing can replace a currency. But if you think about how and what you can do with some data, you can transfer it to somebody else. You can pay for services via your mobile company using the data balance you have on your phone. And you can withdraw it. And you can actually use it as simple data or as airtime. Then we're very far along the road of what a cryptocurrency kind of tried to represent for us. And as our mobile service providers start looking more like banks, you can expect our banks to start looking more like mobile service providers. And as I say, the adoption here in Africa has been pretty good, but some other more developed countries, Sweden, for example, is pushing very hard to have their citizens sort of give up the real world currencies and move to more digital versions of it. And in time, that might be then giving up the fiat currencies they're worth, as it were, for something that's based on something else. But that is very much speculative. I'd imagine us just getting more digital with our current currencies rather than getting rid of them altogether.
Well, that's a big thing, you know, Colin. That's the thing. I don't think that many central banks, well, maybe they're starting to understand now, but many central banks really get the whole virtual currency across borders thing. They were taken totally by surprise. And I think money launderers and others just wanting to take money out of the country had a field day.
They did in the short term, although most of our currencies now already are all virtual. Banks don't hold any of the cash that the world actually has. So that's not entirely an issue that the central banks had. They were never interested in actually issuing physical money for all that stuff. And in terms of how they move money between countries and between each other, that's not a bad system. It's certainly still much more effective than any cryptocurrency. However, what cryptocurrency did show them is that their system isn't the best system. And so I think there's going to be the challenge, the disruption that it brought is going to help how central banks and everybody else improves the technology that they're using to the benefit of all of us, rather than it simply being, you know, one will win and one will die. This is an evolution and it's a pretty good one in the way that it actually happened in the long term. Although I do feel for anybody who got taken in by hoaxes and scams and, you know, investing money that they never really were going to return on. Then one that I think we need to tread a little more cautiously, and this is CRISPR or the gene editing, a fascinatingly amazing breakthrough technology. Certainly wonderful opportunities for us now, editing plant species to try and make them more resistant, etc. And in time, you know, doing that on animals. But late last year, it was announced or claimed by a scientist that he'd managed to do gene editing on a set of twins to make them HIV resistant. That, I think, is a bridge too far just right now. We have no idea exactly how all of the systems will work and the implications of it further down the road. So doing one of these without proper controls, and as I have seen, I haven't found any validation or verification to say that this actually was the case, and certainly not that the claim would turn out to be true. I can't imagine somebody saying, we're now going to try and knowingly infect you with HIV to show that we've made you HIV resistant. I don't think anybody's going to do that. So how you even go about making that as a claim or test is kind of crazy.
There are all sorts of ethical problems there, all sorts of questions there.
There certainly are. And the next one is a lot closer to home for us in terms of it's here right now. And this is machine learning. We already understand how impressive it is when you talk to a machine and it understands what you want from it and give you answers, and how when you search for images, it just finds things, or you travel anywhere on the internet and somehow all of these products you didn't even know you were thinking about or wanting to buy, which you actually clicked on at some point, is now appearing up in your results. So all of that sort of stuff, again, this is the sort of magic element of it, because we really don't understand how it works. And truthfully, when it comes to machine learning, nobody really knows exactly how the machines or what the machines are doing to work out why a three is a three, but they do. And the issues there then are less technological. We've bested ourselves at just about any game we can think of. The challenges there are the ethical and the legal ones. Who should have access access, what kind of access, what should it be used for, who is going to regulate and control it. And again, that is certainly an area where the progress is great, but the opportunity for it to be abused is just as great, and certainly lots of things can go wrong. And when you consider, not necessarily the AI part, but how people can use great technology for bad, well, then this is where the Facebook mention comes in, because they might not have intended for it to be used to, you know, change people's minds or steal information and do whatever else. They were, I think, a little bit naive not to expect that people would do that, given how much people had access to and what their tools actually allowed them to do. But hopefully that was a very big wake-up call. And for us, for the future, knowing that we're going to have much better, greater technologies that are coming along, and that each of them come with some very real drawbacks, shouldn't be a reason for us to say, let's not welcome the technology. It should rather be for us to say, we don't have to be silly about this anymore. You got to think about everything that could go wrong first before you start selling us what can go right. That, I hope, will give you happy 2019.
The only thing is, you know, Colin, when it comes to access to information, you look at Facebook, you and I are chatting tonight, and after the show, I think, oh, who is Colin Cullis? So I go and I have a look at your profile. And all of a sudden, on your side, you get this thing that pops up. Ray White is looking at you. And it goes on and goes on. And then it's sort of a guy from a department store then phone. And it's all interconnected. You feel quite violated, don't you?
You would, but this is an adjustment, because every time we've had something new come along like this, you probably had the same thing. When telephones first came along, I'm willing to bet anybody that installed them was horrified that basically anybody who had that number could just ring you out of the blue, who could just speak to you. And some of the original scams happened exactly that way. Somebody would come to your home, tell you, they'd lie about why they're there and ask to use the telephone. They'd then use your home telephone and call you at work and tell you they've just taken over your house. And unless you settle up this amount and this payment, you know, we're gonna rob your house. We're gonna do harm to your wife and children. So the notion of the technology inherently and the privacy issues, this is decades old. We always surprise ourselves sometimes how ill-prepared we are for dealing with it, because, of course, humans are fascinated at the new and the shiny. We hate the change, and we actually don't want to engage ourselves in the underlying complexities that allow all these things to happen. We willfully keep ourselves ignorant because we feel safer that way. It's not to say that you're unsafe when you try and learn about all these things. In fact, I think you're more empowered. You're less likely to get in harm's way. Anybody who's not fully conversant with why passwords are so important and how giving over any information is not a good idea unless you absolutely know what it's for, is setting themselves up for a fail. Not because the technology is inherently flawed, but because humans love taking people for a ride when there is an easy, quick buck to be made. And that's something that's never going to change. Not now, not in the future, because technology is not going to fix that. It's not a technology problem. It's a human one.
It is, but, you know, I hate regulation. I think everybody hates regulation. But do you perhaps think until we understand what we are dealing with, things do need to be heavily regulated, or else you're going to get something like Bitcoin. And it's lovely to be able to take your money out of the country, like all 5 million of it, if you have it. But things need to be regulated, because if you don't, you know, people fall foul of this.
Right. That is a fantastic point, because the issue in the past was this notions of a country would control what's in its country, and very few things live within those borders like that. China is probably unique for having taken a very authoritarian view of how it controls the internet that has allowed it to actually control the internet. But no other country in the world has that kind of capacity, in which case the regulations that a country comes up with aren't sufficient. It's taken the EU to collectively bring the likes of Facebook and Google to enact certain policies that aren't harmful to the residents of the EU. But an individual country anymore can't do that. So the notion of how we regulate and who will regulate it is key. And I haven't seen too many bodies come forward that have the capacity or the support of other governments to say, we're going to hand over another thing of our sovereignty to allow somebody else to regulate how our citizens will access the internet and how they will work it.
Interesting discussion tonight. Colin, I've really thoroughly enjoyed talking to you tonight. It's been absolutely fantastic. Thank you.
Pleasure.